Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 18th, 2006. Today's session is entitled White Privilege, Who Wins? Presented by Verlon Brown, number BRV 2006-02. Let's listen in.
Okay, we'll start with the people inside the circle. The people who are part of the circle. Observations, feelings, what?
It was a struggle to keep the people from outside.
It was a struggle. Okay.
Especially this one.
Some of you winded, I can
tell. All of your attention went to protecting the circle as opposed to anything letting me go on inside the circle. Oh, it's right behind you. I'm going to watch you.
Oh, this is fine.
It took a lot of energy.
You can feel the tension rising there too.
Yeah. Tension rising from who?
Both sides.
Both sides. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
That was really interesting that as soon as someone said that they had a relative outside of the circle, there was suspicion as to whether or not that person would let those people in.
Oh, yeah.
No. Wait, no. Absolutely not. If it was my sister, absolutely not.
Yeah, but the suspicion was there.
There was suspicion.
Suspicion.
Yeah. We were all bond with
people. You know. With people you were...
common bond.
All right.
I'd like to know how you knew how to get around and keep them out. That was a beautiful move.
Do you really have to ask that question?
No.
You did a great job.
All right. Any more comments from the people who made the circle?
Yeah, they got violent.
They did. They got violent.
I'm in there no matter what.
Okay. Now for the people who were trying to get into the circle, what was that like for you?
Well, if you notice, I didn't even go near my sisters. I went to somebody totally different because I knew that they weren't going to let me in.
Okay.
I felt the sense of initial when I first got in because they were like, come in, oh yeah, you want to get in? And so I thought the object was just to get in, and then I felt betrayal because once I was in, they pushed me back out. I had to fight to get back in. But I thought it was just going to be a fight to get in, but I didn't realize it was going to be a fight to stay in and that I was going to be pushed back out.
And how does that feel when
it was initially a sense of betrayal, but then the fight became stronger for me to get in, and then trying to band together with the people that were in the middle, trying to protect ourselves and protect the people so that we could stay together inside the circle.
Okay. And it wasn't until, it wasn't until you guys banded together that we could exclude you all as a group.
I mean, that's
interestingly enough. It wasn't you guys were all huddled together.
All of a sudden,
yeah. And then I saw at one point it looked like you had decided to make your own group. Was that?
Yeah, I was thinking let's make our own group outside.
Okay. Let's see. What else?
I thought the interesting thing for me was, you had to sort of develop a little strategy for how to get into the group. And that was sort of challenging.
Uh-huh.
But once you got in the group, you had to be more on your toes.
Yeah.
To keep safe from them than you ever had to on the outside.
Right.
Because they weren't worried about us on the outside as long as we weren't trying to get into their circle.
Yeah.
They weren't following us or anything, until we were trying to break in or get in.
Okay.
I was impressed with both how skilled the big circle was at not letting us in, but equally skilled at keeping us out once we got in.
Yes.
That was just surprised by that.
Okay. Well, good. For those of you who came in late, what we did was made a circle. I picked four people to try to get into the circle, and the people in the circle, their instructions were to keep the people out at all costs. And the people outside the circle, their instructions were to get in the circle at all costs. And then mayhem ensued.
But there was one other thing that you added to us.
Okay.
That we were to invite them.
Oh!
We were to kind of...
You were to invite them in.
All right. But we really didn't mean it, did we?
Okay. For those, in case you haven't figured it out, That's a metaphor for our society. There are people trying to get into the circle. And those circles are institutions. Name them off. There's about 12 institutions. Name them off and I'll try to write it down.
Schools.
Schools. Government.
Professions.
What?
Professions.
Professions. Church.
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 Family.
Family? No, you don't really get paid to be in a family. Mm-hmm. What other kind of institutions?
Mm. Clubs, private. Social clubs.
Social clubs. Well, you don't get paid to be in a social club.
Military.
Military. Exactly. That's one of the worst. Mm. What else? How about the
hospitals?
Hospitals, okay.
Government.
Hospitals.
Yeah, that's financial institutions, loan, all getting rid of
banks.
Exactly. Housing?
Well, and housing, yeah. I just going to say that. Housing.
Okay, I'll put down housing. What else? How about Hollywood?
Mm. Entertainment.
Entertainment. What else? Anything else you can think of?
Sports management, professional sports.
Okay, sports. This may or may not come under entertainment. what else? Yeah.
Teams winning.
Anything else we can think of? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Well, you get the gist. I can't think of any more. So, these are all institutions where people make their living. And if you cannot get in those institutions, then it's going to be difficult for you to make a living. And oftentimes, people of color, women to a certain extent, find it hard to get into these institutions. Therefore, you become marginalized. And you have to figure out a way to make a living outside of these institutions.
Does church belong there on that list, do you think?
Yeah, church is an institution. I mean, you got
to... No, but the idea of making a living.
Yeah,
yep.
Making
I'm thinking of members of a congregation.
Oh,
right.
I don't mean members of a congregation. I mean church in terms of profession. So that's part of what we deal with when we deal with what we call racism, is this inability to get into the group, into these various institutions. This is called the cycle of oppression, and this is kind of how oppression works. You have a target group, you have misinformation, you have mistreatment, and then you have internalized oppression. And if you notice from our group, you know, after a while, some people just sort of gave up trying to get into the circle. They were exhausted. They kind of band together inside the circle as a group. But they had given up on trying. Can I have a seat? She wants to be from the Midwest.
Is that misinformation?
So they were trying to get in and they couldn't get in, and they were targeted as people you didn't want to let in. So you had the mistreatment of blocking them out. I mean, you had the misinformation about them, and then the mistreatment, and then they felt like, oh God, what, you know, that sort of thing. And this, you can put anyone in this target group. You can put women, misinformation about women, mistreatment, internalized. You know, you can put old people, young people, whatever you want to put, you can put in there. And that's how oppression works. That's that cycle of oppression. But then we'll move into American oppression. There's this guy by the name of Joel Fagan, who talks about that racism in America begins with the Constitution itself, and that the Constitution needs to be changed because the Constitution itself was written by racist people with a racist agenda. That it was written by 55 elite white males, not just regular white guys, but elite white guys. And all of these guys made their living from the slave trade. They either sold slaves, used slaves, bought and sold goods that were made by slaves. All of these guys got rich off the slave trade. And then they write a constitution that does not include black people. And that slaves, if it wasn't for the slaves, there wouldn't have been, we couldn't have been able to win the Revolutionary War, because slaves made all the products that you use in war. And then slavery, ancestors of slaves, also with their backs, made it possible for the Industrial Revolution as well. Black people moving up from the South to those Midwestern states, making cars and all of that sort of thing. So Mr. Fagan, Joe Fagan's thing is that the Constitution itself needs to be changed. By the way, Jesse Jackson Jr.'s son, he roams around giving talks about how we need to amend certain parts. We need more amendments into the Constitution to deal with things such as schools and education, because the way it is now, there's nothing in it for white people to make education better to go to the lengths you have to go through to make education better for children of color. Whereas if it were in our part of our, if it was constitutional rather than state by state, using states' rights, there would be more, that's less, anyway, I lost my train of thought. That's what happens when you get old. But anyway, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I'll skip. I'll come back to it like that. So anyway, oppression is listed as unjust enrichment for unjust impoverishment. So basically, America has unjust whites in America have unjust enrichment. For unjust impoverishment on the black people who created, who did a lot of the work. And so this list over here is a list of things, and I'll go through it real quick just to give you an idea. Overseers, well, one of the things that is mentioned is that capitalists, in a capitalist society, there's really only two classes, the haves and the have-nots. And that in this society, the haves made a deal with the white. The white haves made a deal with the white have-nots and said that if you become overseers, you will get privileges and entitlements. And the whites said, okay. And that permeates through our society, whites as overseers, and basically keeping black people and other people of color from moving up and infiltrating the circle of the haves. So it started off with whites as overseers, getting various entitlements for their treatment and their restricting and keeping black people initially out of the circle. In 1790, the Naturalization Act made it possible for all free whites to vote, serve on juries and own property. It was only for free white people.
Free white males.
Free white males, exactly. To come in, and they also opened the door for Europe as well. They also opened the door for Europe as well, for Europe immigrants as well. Then in 1862, the Homestead Act, 270 million acres, about 10% of the western part of the U.S., land taken from Native Americans, were given to white males and their families. Only white males. After slavery, supposedly General Sherman said that blacks should get 40 acres and a mule. You should split up the plantations and give blacks 40 acres and a mule. That never happened. But some slaveholders got $300 for every slave they had for compensation for the slave that they lost. So for every slave they lost, they got $300. Wow. Then you get into sharecropping, Jim Crow, which is all just an extension of sort of halfway in the circle, meaning you weren't a slave, you weren't a legal slave anymore, but of course you had all these apartheid-like restrictions. And then the Social Security Act of 1935, which, you know, you could get Social Security, but it didn't extend to agricultural workers or domestics, which was what most black people and Asian people and various people of color were. So another thing where whites got more advantages. 1935, the Wagner Act, unions, only whites could get into the unions. That didn't change until the mid-70s. And of course, our friend Ronald Reagan busted the unions starting in the 80s.
Actually, Richard Nixon started breaking unions as racist in the 1970s in Philadelphia.
Okay. We didn't busted them as racist.
He, using civil rights laws, he began breaking the pipefitters unions in Philadelphia in 1972, charging them with racism.
All right. And then you get in, so as a general rule, white Americans have 8 times the wealth of the average black Americans. African Americans in 1865 owned about 0.5% of the property. Of the country's wealth, now it's about 1% today. And with all the advantages that whites have been allowed to achieve over the years using racist tactics and exclusion and that sort of stuff, one of the lowest estimations would say that white Americans in the U.S. have profited about $1 trillion. That's what it's about. That's what it's worth in terms of. Paul and I were talking last night, and we remembered this quote where this guy was saying that it's as if we were playing Monopoly, and it would be whites, you know, a black person against a white person, and or anybody, I should say, but if people were playing Monopoly, and halfway through the game, one person said, "Hey, you're cheating," and the other guy says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I won't cheat anymore. We'll play fair from now on." Meanwhile, they have all the boardwalks, all the railroads, all, you know. So it's that kind, of a thing. And let's not forget the prison industrial complex, which is growing. It's the most growing industry in the U.S. right now. And I put a question mark because the reality is it looks a lot like slavery. You know, you have all of these people of color going into jail. The population of whites in jail is about 1%. And you have all these people going into jails in small towns. And then you have small town people without a high school education or with a high school education who were the guards. And it's kind of an overseer thing all over again. In small towns, it's one of the jobs where you can make a fairly good living with just a high school education, being a guard at a prison. And most of the guards in small town prisons are white. And then you have all of the various, what do they call them? The name slips my mind, but vendors who go in and out of the prison systems and make money off of food, making, you know, food and all the things that it takes to run a prison, most of whom are white as well. So once again, we're back to whites profiting off the backs of people of color. Who knows who John Brown is? Who can tell me something about John Brown?
He is an abolitionist, and he led slaves on a raid at Harper's Ferry, which started the Civil War.
Okay. And white. He was
white.
And he was an abolitionist against what?
Slavery.
He wanted to end slavery.
Wasn't he a Kansan?
Hmm?
Was he a Kansas?
Kansas.
He was
Kansas.
Yes. He was from Kansas.
I'm from Indiana, and he says I'm not from the Midwest.
She's a wannabe. Indiana is a wannabe.
She's right on that borderline.
Exactly.
Daylight savings.
With that prison industrial complex, the people in jail are often doing work, labor for a small cost.
Exactly.
Small salary.
Did you hear what she said? Say it again.
But a lot of people in prison are often doing menial types of labor that the community is benefiting from, or the country is benefiting from, because you go, okay, well, the jailers, the prisoners can do this kind of task, and I don't know exactly what all they've done, but I do have really few stuff.
Is
this
the license plate?
They make desks and furniture for state prisoners. At least in Washington State. They're not allowed to make stuff and sell it on the market because this is a strong union state.
In Oregon, they manufacture denim jeans called prison denims for retail purchase.
In Texas, they make dog computers.
But in Washington State, it's now against the law. They brought a suit that said they cannot compete on the open market with people outside the prison.
But the reason
because they're not paid. Oh, okay.
But now the union.
They get paid, but it's a pittance.
It's like 50 cents an hour.
Yeah,
it's 2 cents an hour.
But they get room and board.
We all do realize that the exception to the slavery law and the anti-slavery law in the United States is for those who are legally in prison.
Yeah. Yeah.
They can still work as slave laborers, according to our Constitution.
They were doing telemarketing, too, by the way.
Yes.
That's
right. What was it? The telemarketing units got upset because they couldn't compete with it.
But, you know, as Seinfeld says, you know, prison, you know, aside from the sodomy, isn't that bad.
John Brown.
We're live. Simon is here.
Talk
to your father.
Are you thinking he has worse than streets?
He's not on the streets.
Maybe it's the same vocabulary.
Okay, John Brown. So anyway, there's this guy who started this movement. His name is Noel Ignatieff. Has anyone ever heard of him? Noel Ignatieff. Peter has heard of him. But Peter has a PhD. All he does is read. So anyway,
better than Sodom.
So
can you spell
anyway,
that?
Ignatieve?
Yeah. Can you write it?
Sure.
No.
Is he in the circle?
He's in it, but they're trying to push him out.
That's how you spell it. Ignatieve. And he started this abolitionist movement. And his thing, his abolitionist movement, and John Brown was their leader, and his abolitionist movement was that people should become abolitionists against whiteness. Not white people, but whiteness. To abolish all of this. And that was his thing, is that we should abolish whiteness and all that that means. And if you go online, he has a website, of course, with all, he's a Harvard professor, and he has a website, of course, with all of this kind of, you know, all of the stuff that he writes about it. He wrote a book called When the Irish Were Black, and it's basically a historical thing about when the Irish first came here, they were treated poorly, and then somewhere along the line, they figured out, you know, if we mistreat black people, they'll treat us like white people. And that's exactly what happened. And so he said that, his thing is that white America is in agreement, you know, with, you know, that the top 1% who got 43% of the Bush tax breaks, that they are in agreement to be overseers. In that to be white in this country is to be an overseer and make an agreement that say we will lock black people and brown people out. And he also says that different races come into the country, immigrate into the country, and see right away that, you know, if we lock black people out, they will let us in. Mm-hmm. And so brown people can do that too. Mm-hmm. You know, Asian people can do that too. Other people of color can do that too. In fact, all of Europe has done it. No matter what part of Europe they're from, the Eastern Bloc of Europe has come in this country and seen how things work and have agreed to lock people of color out. And the moment you do that, you lock, you decide to become an overseer. Then you get these privileges.
So, Verlana, when you're talking about whiteness, are you talking about that activity of locking out, or are you talking about whiteness as a category of being white, male, straight, affluent?
No, I'm talking about white people.
Right, and that's why I'm asking.
I'm talking about
whiteness.
That ability to lock people out, that agreement to become an overseer.
That's whiteness.
That's whiteness. Right. You know.
But that's what Ignatieve is fighting against. That's what he wants to get rid of.
Yeah, that's what he says that we should abolish, is we should disrupt. Because the status quo is overseeing. The status quo is gatekeeping. The status quo is locking black people out. And he says that we should be about disrupting that at any possible way that we can.
Okay. But doesn't it translate over to the actual skin color of a person? Like the Asian people refer to people, you're a banana. You're yellow on the outside, but you're white on the inside. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like that's your attitude. You're trying to adapt an attitude of a white person so that you will fit in. But you can't really because you're yellow on the outside. So that's.
But you can agree to be an overseer. You can agree with the terms of being an overseer, and you can lock people out. And you know, we have names for people like that, apples, you know, like you said, bananas, that whole kind of thing. But if you say I'm not going to be an overseer, then you're locked out. You're like these people who are trying to get into the circle. You know, if you say no, I'm not going to tell that black person we don't have housing, because we do have housing. you know, I'm not going to tell that black person that we're not hiring, because we are hiring, you know. And Ignatius's whole thing is that there's a whole level, just like this, there's a whole level of supports, information that whites have access to that people who are locked out never hear about, you know. And that once you decide to become an overseer, you don't, black people don't get in there. Other people of color don't get into that unless they agree to be an overseer. Right. And then you let them in there.
An interesting piece of the others, I mean, the racial divide in the United States is usually split black and white. And that's in part because of what our Constitution said and did. Up until 1952, you could only be a naturalized U.S. citizen if you were African or white. And people had to plead before the Supreme, up to the Supreme Court for the right to be naturalized. All but about two of the cases pleaded on the basis of being white. Almost nobody chose to plead on the basis of being black to become a naturalized U.S. citizen. Interestingly enough, in the 1920s, two cases decided within 3 months of each other. One was a Japanese man who raised his family here, a successful businessman, was told that he wasn't Caucasian and was denied citizenship. The next one was an Indian who was Caucasian but clearly wasn't white according to the same nine Supreme Court justices. So, like the circle that we had, it keeps moving what whiteness is and how we're going to define it to make sure that we lock people in or out.
Is that what stimulated all the selections now that you have? You have to put down, well, you're Asian, they put Eskimo on some of these different government types of access to funds, as an example, to qualify as a minority type. They have these little categories that you... Does that all come from...
I don't know for sure, but I think that's actually a reaction to what we had up until 1952.
I think you can agree to be an overseer inadvertently, too, or unconsciously is a better word. And I'm thinking of my own field, where the historically in education, the canon in literature dead white males. We know that. But that creates an incredible load of misinformation to people, and it perpetuates the status quo. But anybody who, for example, I'm just trying to be concrete, who teaches English and follows that canon has agreed to continue to be an overseer. And I'm going to keep Richard Wright out of this canon. I'm going to keep Zora, and on and on we can go. And I suspect, I don't know other fields, I know peripherally only, but we do that in every branch of our education, too.
Yeah. I'd say that looking at the 8 times the wealth that the average white family has over the average black family, a lot of that is real estate. And it feels like one of the places that's just a real bottleneck for people of color to get in, that if you're redlined, there's still, even recent studies done, there was a telephone study done not long ago where a person was identified either with a really identifiable African-American name, was interested in buying some property, had a script to follow, someone would call, who sounded very similar, had clearly an Anglo name, calling the same people, and we're still getting, you wouldn't get what you needed, you wouldn't get the financing you needed if you had the African-sounding name, African-American-sounding name. So it's still going on, and that really is the basis of the huge wealth disparity, or one big basis of wealth disparity,
60%
is banking practices.
African-Americans and Hispanics can't get loans to buy property. And then you got all this free property that whites got over the years that they're passing down to their kids, you know, that, you know, people of color have no access to.
Right.
So you're right.
Land. That's your monopoly game you were talking about.
Yeah.
And that gets passed down. It just keeps the disparity going.
Yep.
Another piece of PBS trivia. $120 billion in U.S. funds were set aside for the Federal Housing Administration between 1944, let's say, end of World War II, and 1964, the Fair Housing Administration. Less than 2%, the redlining that you cited was an official U.S. government policy.
Right.
It was not something that the credit card people invented, something that our federal government invented. Less than 2% of that $120 billion was allowed to go to African Americans.
Any more?
Well, just
I'm sorry, Indiana.
I have a question, actually. Do you know if there are nonprofit organizations or something similar that would, like, find or get loans based on someone's record as opposed to, like, to apply for them anonymously to get around that disparity?
I don't know.
There's a lot of nonprofits that collect capital and issue those loans because they know the traditional financial institutions won't. And most financial institutions, if they want to do banking, have to comply with the Consumer Investment Act. Mm-hmm. And most of them choose to put money into these intermediary nonprofits because it's a lot easier to give them $1 million and let them deal with the black people than to try to figure out and train their folks how to give loans on a fair basis. That's where a good chunk in urban centers, especially African American and Latino people, are getting loans, is from nonprofit organizations that really are intermediary lenders.
There's a small business administration that has a loan policy for minority-owned businesses. So if you're a minority business, which you have to go through and check one of those little boxes so that you qualify, what it actually amounts to is that the government really isn't loaning you the money. They're just guaranteeing the local bank that should you default on the loan, the government will then pick up the note. However, I applied for one of those loans. And when you go through and you look at all the things, I finally got to the point, I could go out on my own with my own personal assets and do a lot better than what this program the government has put together. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know where that fits on that up there.
We're going to move into that in just a minute. Yes?
I hesitate bringing this up. At the same time, I need to. And this is what I've observed. In the schools, the public schools, yes, we have the forms that ask whether you're Caucasian, whether you're Asian, whether you're black, whether you're all of them. And this is the reason why, because if you're a minority, the schools get more money. However, what I would define as, I understand the past white and black, but it's really in the schools. It isn't a color issue that I see anymore. It's we give more money for the minorities, but the minorities aren't the ones that have the technology. And I'm talking about Asian, black, mm-hmm. Native American, Russian, Middle East. I mean, the schools have been flooded.
Yeah.
It's the haves and the have-nots. It's those families that have the money to provide their children with the technology.
Okay.
And those who don't.
All right.
And that is what I see as discrimination.
So let's move out. One of the things that Ignatieff talks about is moving out of the personal. I'm reminded of, I'm sure most people here saw The Godfather, right? Mm-hmm. What was a common saying in The Godfather?
It's not business. It's not personal. It's business.
Not personal. It's just business. And that's what it comes down to when it comes to this. And it's kind of I like to think of Christianity is the same way. A lot of people have personal stories that accepted Jesus Christ as their personal savior. That kind of thing. We hear that all the time. But unless you're willing to put your body on the line, at some point, who cares? And it's the same way with this. I don't care if you like black people or Asian people. I don't care if you slept with them. I don't care if they're your best friend. It simply doesn't matter. What matters is if you're willing to put your body on the line. And ultimately, it's you put your body on the line, not for personal stuff, but for the sake of our country. You know, and that's what Ignatieve says is his bottom line in terms of disrupting the status quo. It's not a personal thing. It's not so you can get even with the man. You know, the reality is you disrupt the status quo because you're putting your body on the line to put an end to all of this. Because all of this still, you know, like I said, 43% of all the tax benefits that this administration has pushed has gone to the upper 1%. And it's like, why? You know, why are we continuing this, you know, this overseeing stuff for that? Who's getting it? Most of it is going to the top 1%. So that's Ignatieve saying, is that if it's beyond the personal doesn't matter. And, you know, I don't care if you like black people, Asian people, whatever. The point is to move from the personal to the global, you know. And that's his point. And his point is also that our job, if we're serious about ending racism in this country, and therefore in the world, you know, of course, because, you know, we export our racism out. If we want to put an end to overseeing, if we want to put an end to going to brown countries and bombing them, we do that by disrupting the status quo. And that's our task, is to figure out how to disrupt the status quo. And in my hand, I have a list of things we can do to disrupt the status quo. Some of this I got from Ignatieve. Some of it I got from Michael Moore. And so I'll read that list to you, and then we'll open it up for comments and whatever. Give everyone the assumption of worthiness, competence, and innocence. Vote, choose, or hire only people of color. Michael Moore says, he said that he was never going to hire another white person again to work for him. If everybody who's in the position of hiring people said, I will never hire another white person to work for me, think what an impact that would make. If only 100 people in a state said that we're only going to hire people of color, we're only going to vote for people of color, think what a difference that would make. And I know this stuff is radical, it's kind of crazy. You know, who seriously thinks I'm only going to hire a black person? I mean, I'm only going to hire people of color. But it's no more sillier than this, you know.
Well, it makes sense for a lot. If you buy what Paul was saying, that we're unconsciously, by participating in the status quo as it is, we're propagating it, even if we don't mean to be.
Yeah.
So we have some ownership already of what's going on here.
Yeah.
So this is radical only in that it's different than what we're doing now. Yeah. And it becomes less radical if we feel like we're owning to some degree, even unwittingly, what's going on.
I can't tell you how many conversations I've participated in over the years upholding Bill's Village of how come we can't get more black people or people of color at the village? You know, decide the next director is going to be African American. I don't care. You know, we have maybe the look will be longer, whatever you have to do, but we decided that the next, you know, director of Holden Village is going to be African American. Think what an impact that would make. You know, or the next lawns and garden person, or the next, you know, you name it. You know. Yes, amen.
Do you think that, or do we think that, like, I know this is the idea is to disrupt the status quo, but I always look for the problems and the, you know, arguments, that white people would ever bring a racist call to someone who said, I'm not hiring whites?
Say that again.
Do you think that white people who are applying for jobs mm-hmm. would ever deign to take a racist suit against?
Sure. Oh,
they already have. University of California Law School.
University of Rocky.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let me read these off and then we can talk.
Okay.
All right. Be honest. The third one is be honest. Don't pretend that you have any concern whatsoever for people of color. The fourth is look in the mirror, change yourself. The fifth one is marry a person of color. Make sure your children aren't white.
What if you already got started?
Well, you are adopted. You can adopt another one. But, you know, think what an impact this would make if this stuff you passed on to brown people. All this property that for 15 generations, all this free property that was taken from Native Americans, if you have a brown child, a brown niece, a brown nephew, a brown grandchild, and you begin to pass that stuff on to them, think what an impact that would be. Six, be humble. You don't live on the front lines. Seven, refuse to label someone's experience as an isolated incident. Eight, listen especially hard when it's difficult to listen. When you notice yourself getting defensive, as hearing from people of non-dominant groups that what you or white people you know did was offensive. Listen carefully for effects they describe instead of justifying your original intent. Nine, use your privilege to make sure that others who don't have privilege have their voices heard. 10, oppose tracking in schools. 11, oppose all mechanisms that favor whites in the job market. 12, oppose the courts and the police that wish to define black people as a criminal class. 13, seek to disrupt and even abolish white privilege. 14, answer an anti-white slur with, "Oh, you probably think I'm white. That's a mistake that people often make because I look white." And 15, when someone says that women on welfare are lazy and don't want to work, say, "Yeah, me too." So, that's where we are. That's how I'll end it. Any questions?
What's the president?
Cyclone oppression.
Jonathan Coulthold, the guy who wrote Savage Inequality, is talking about a lot of the especially poverty-based disparities in American education. Has this great comeback. I'm reminded of the one based on the last two of that list. But he says he gets the question a lot from people who are pretty wealthy, who he criticizes the education system, and they always say to him, "So what are you going to do, throw money at it? You just throw money at the system?" And his standard response is, "Well, it worked for your kids." I really like that.
I think both nationally and internationally and globally, it means, too, that people of privilege have to give something up. If we own 99%, right, and somebody else owns 1%, there is only 100%. And a concrete illustration of that, those people who, and again, I'm talking about my own profession, who cling to the canon and say that these are the guys you have to have kids learn about, well, I'm sorry, but Ernest Hemingway has to go. That's really hard. And we have to be able to kind of let go of some of the secure things and the visions that we've had. This is the truth about, I'm talking about literature now, just to be concrete, you can put it in any venue you want to. But we have to give up. And then globally, I said locally and specifically in education, we give up the canon. Globally, we give up. Maybe we don't drive an SUV because we know that we contribute 20. Does that all make sense, pulling that together? That we contribute 25% of the pollution? Maybe we got to give up some of that. And that's part of the pain, is that we're privileged, and boy, golly, to chip away at that.
What Ignatie pushes is that what you want to do is be a troublemaker. You know, you want to disrupt the status quo. You know, and you don't have to make a big deal about that. You don't have to stand on your soapbox and say, "I'm disrupting the status quo." You can just quietly disrupt the status quo. You know, and not make it easy for this to continue, for this white privilege to continue to pass from generation to generation. Because we're not only destroying the people of color in this country, but as you can tell, we're moving around the world, dropping bombs on brown countries like Maine, you know. So it's more than just this country, you know. So his thing is start here, start disrupting the status quo here, and you know, and pass that on.
But Vernon, that would be making some sacrifices, wouldn't it?
I'm not sure. I mean, if you like to make trouble, you can make trouble without making sacrifices, can't you? Say you have, I mean, how
hard
is it?
Makes a real impact.
How hard is it to have a baby by a black man? That's not hard. And then automatically,
it's extremely difficult for me.
But you wouldn't know by looking.
But for your wife, it wasn't such a bad thing. And then you begin to pass this stuff, you know, you begin to pass this stuff down. It's not as big of a sacrifice, you know, as you think. I mean, start small. Take baby steps. Say no to something. You know? Yeah.
I have two brown grandchildren. They told me that they're not black. They're tan, I think it is. Mm. Anyway, they are the best ambassadors that you've ever imagined to learn to love someone of another color.
Exactly.
And that starts with children.
The subversive acts, if you go back to your circle of the misinformation and the mistreatment that's where subversion counts, one of those four points, right? You either correct misinformation or balance misinformation if you're a literature teacher or something.
No, the subversiveness in this is to not to do it in the first place.
Yeah, so to undermine those.
Yeah, yeah, you know, so this contributes to this. You know, these people, I worked for what I got. Misinformation like mad.
So last night at the forum, I was real intrigued by one of your questions. I don't know if it was rhetorical or if you were thinking on it, but last night we were talking about entry into the economic system. And that an individual can rise up, you know, and prove themselves. And then the forum folks were saying, well, actually, no individual can do that. You've got to be as part of the group.
Yeah.
And your question was, well, wait a minute. What's with this lie that any one person can go and do that?
Yeah.
Well, can you connect that question for me with...
Well, our mythology is that a person can pull themselves up by their bootstraps and rise to the top of the heap. We pick out stars all the time, like Lance Armstrong, Shaquille O'Neal, anybody. We make it appear that these guys made it to the top on their own. Well, anybody who knows anything about sports knows that Lance Armstrong has 20 people pushing him forward. Shaquille O'Neal has 20 different coaches, and he still can't make a foul shot. You know, he has 20 you know, coaches, you know. To move them forward. So reality is that because of this, whites are where they are today. So it's an insult to tell a person of color to pick themselves up by the bootstraps when we've dismantled all of this for them. You know, any kind of support, any kind of privilege that's passed on from generation to generation, there's nothing passed on from generation to generation for black people. When my parents died, we sold a house and I got $300. That's the legacy that they passed financially, that they passed on to me. So, you know, and I was an exception because most of the people I grew up with, their parents didn't own their home.
So really there's no boots to begin with.
Yeah.
I think one of the other things folks can do if they really want to push it is when you get home, call your state legislator and ask them to make drunk driving have the same penalties as possession of cocaine, crack cocaine, and other drugs that blacks are in prison for, and make it a three-strike penalty. Because the argument is driving while intoxicated contributes almost exactly to the 1,000 number of deaths as the cocaine-related drugs. Mm-hmm. Yet, cocaine-related drugs are prosecuted as felonies, and very quickly, a small amount of possession, having somebody in your house who has possession, and something else, and three strikes, boom, you're in prison for life. And cocaine, the cocaine industry has very selectively targeted African-American neighborhoods as the holders of cocaine, although the larger percentage of users are white suburbanites. So I think it would be interesting if every state, especially ones with three strike laws, and then prison for life, had equal penalties for driving after three glasses of wine instead of two.
Our job, if we choose to accept it, is to disrupt the status quo of things as they are. Did you have any idea?
Well, I'm just wondering, this all makes me think, so what do you think of the movement for reparations to descendants of slaves?
You know, I think it's, you know, yeah, I'm for it, but I don't think it's ever going to happen. Because whites see that as taking money out of their pockets.
Money.
That's why Jesse Jackson Jr. was saying the Constitution needs to be changed, because the Constitution favors whites. And if it is changed, it can favor everybody. Yeah.
We've had education mentioned a couple times as an important spot where these issues play out. And I just want to really agree, because as someone who's recently been through high school and done the American history textbooks, they're incredibly blasé. They say, a game of Monopoly was played. Here's how it went. I took an AP history class my senior year of high school, where the teacher said, for every chapter you read in the textbook, you're also going to read a chapter in Howard Zinn's book about that same time period. And it was just like reading two different histories. One said, here's the game. The other one said, this is why we were cheating. And the majority of, I mean, and it was an incredible amount of reading. I mean, that's an example of where 100% was the textbook. You said, put an extra 50% in and read this book too. And without that perspective, I would have no idea about this stuff. And I think maybe another positive step would be to be honest about this history. Because what you're telling us about American history here is not getting into the years of people in public school systems, generally speaking, unless you have a teacher who says, hey, read this book too. And there's just not a good way to see this through our standard education. Yeah.
That's generally true of world history at the high school and the college, yeah, and even the graduate school level here in the U.S.
You're marginalized if you focus on just the marginalized texts.
You're marginalized if you include the marginalized texts.
That's what I mean.
Not focus on what, but include them.
As we are talking about things that we can do, we look to our hearts. And as Christians, if we use that as a base, the word that's been passed down to us, this is the operating manual of conducting our lives.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think Christ is continually moving us from the personal to the global, you know. And I'm not saying that the personal doesn't matter. It does matter to you. And it should matter to you. But then you got to move it to the global, you know. And that's the Christian message. And that's the message of this whole thing as well. So go out and disrupt. Okay.